You're listening to Ship History Radio from the Steamship Historical Society of America. Through recording, preserving, and educating, our mission is to share the impact of engine-powered vessels, their crews, and their passengers with future generations. I'm Amy Bachari, the Education Director, and today I'm joined by our curator, Jordan Burson, who will discuss the Elmo N. Pickerel Collection at SSHSA and why it's so important. You'll hear about the modern controversy surrounding Pickerel's claim to have made the first air-to-ground radio transmission. He was a pioneer in both aviation and wireless telegraphy. Later, he served as the chief radio operator of the SS Leviathan. Can you tell us a little bit about why you feel this collection is so special?
The Elmo Pickerel Collection captures a lot of the minutiae that went on behind the scenes in the radio room and the general operations of that department on a great American ocean liner.
And how did he get such a prestigious job in the first place?
Well, by the time he got the job, Pickerel had already made a name for himself in the fields of aviation and wireless radio telegraphy, and he had been to sea. He was known to be an accomplished and daring innovator with nearly 20 years of experience under his belt by that time. Keep in mind, both radio and aeronautics were basically radical and cutting-edge new technologies in the 1900s and 1910s when Pickerel got his start. Both must have seemed like science fiction at the time, and consequently, aviators and wireless radio operators captivated the public imagination. Early aviators were seen as daredevils and heroes, and wireless radio operators were considered innovators and often heroes as well.
So I imagine people will probably think about the importance of radio technology and telegraphy when they think about the Titanic, for example.
Exactly. These were game-changing technologies. Regular developments in both fields were eagerly reported in the press. Among his accomplishments, Elmo Pickerel was credited with making the first ever airplane-to-ground radio communication while solo piloting a biplane in August of 1910. During the flight, Pickerel was said to have tapped out Morse code that was clearly received by two stations on the beach, three different steamships, and a radio station on a New York City rooftop. He, in turn, received their responses. Now, strangely, this was a historic feat that should have made front-page headlines worldwide, but the event didn't get any such publicity. Today, due to this absence of period news reports, some historians have suggested that Pickerel fabricated the story for the purpose of self-promotion.
Okay, if that's the case, then how did Elmo Pickerel maintain his reputation at the time?
Well, for one, nobody questioned Pickerel's legacy until years after his death. Furthermore, these recent questions do not necessarily mean that he didn't make the first air-to-ground radio contact. All of his friends and colleagues thought very highly of him during his lifetime. There's no question that he was an accomplished early aviator. In fact, at an event covered by the New York Times in February 1961, Pickerel was publicly honored by his peers as an aviation trailblazer. The Times went on to state that Pickerel received his flying lessons from Orville Wright himself.
That's pretty impressive. I would imagine that historians and the general public would have paid attention to what the New York Times had to say.
Yeah, that's likely the case. When Elmo Pickerel passed away just a few years later at the age of 82 in 1968, his obituary in the Times recounted the story of the 1910 flight and other notable points, including that he was one of the early barnstormers who had flown in exhibitions all over the U.S. and across South America. They went on to say that not only had the Wright brothers taught Elmo Pickerel to fly, but that Pickerel had also studied radio with Guglielmo Marconi. When the government started issuing licenses to wireless operators in 1911, Elmo Pickerel reportedly received the very first license, license number one.
That's pretty impressive. I think a lot of people will have heard of Marconi and the Wright brothers, and to think that he was involved with these famous pioneers is really nothing short of amazing.
It is. Pickerel first discovered his interest in radio and then quickly followed that up with his foray into aviation. It all began shortly after Pickerel graduated from Colorado College when he took a job as a railroad telegrapher. It was there and then that he became fascinated with the potential of wireless technology. Pickerel first met another legendary radio entrepreneur by the name of Dr. Lee DeForest at the 1904 St. Louis World's Fair. Pickerel was already considered an outstanding figure in the field of wireless communications at that point, having earned his reputation operating the quote-unquote hot wires for the AP, United Press, and the Hearst newspapers. Very soon after meeting DeForest, Pickerel was working with both DeForest and Marconi on experimental radio projects. This would have been around 1904 and 1905.
And can you tell us a little bit about the nature of these projects that he was working on?
Well, to start, Pickerel had a 10-station wireless telegraphy network set up with DeForest in Colorado, and 3 years later he went on and set up another station atop New York's Waldorf Astoria Hotel. Elmo Pickerel always seemed to find himself involved at the center of exciting events, as well as technological developments. Another news story worth noting occurred in 1910 also, while in that rooftop station. He played an important role in the first ever sea rescue via radio. On the morning of October 15, 1910, an attempt was being made by six men to cross the Atlantic in an airship named the America, with Walter Wellman in command. Also on board America that morning was Jack R. Irwin, the ship's Marconi wireless operator. Now, just for a little background context, Irwin had been involved in some excitement of his own the prior year while working in the Marconi wireless station on Nantucket. There he received a weak CQD distress signal from White Star Lines RMS Republic after having been rammed by the Italian liner Florida. Irwin quickly contacted the Baltic and several other ships in the area, and as a result of his quick action and the efficacy of wireless technology, 1,500 lives were saved in the disaster, which brings us back to the America. Irwin naturally equipped the ship with a radio as a safety measure. And when they made way, Wellman deliberately followed a course over busy sea lanes to increase the chances of nearby assistance in case of emergency. And wouldn't you know it, they ran into engine trouble before long. Fortunately, they spotted Royal Mail's SS Trent at sea below, and Jack Irwin sent a distress call. But he couldn't get a radio response back, as in those days, ships' radios were not usually manned 24/7. So, in desperation, he started flashing CQD to the Trent with a flashlight, while also signaling that their airship was equipped with wireless radio. Louis Ginsberg, the Trent's wireless operator, was alerted. He immediately jumped into action. He fired up the Trent's radio to orchestrate an elaborate rescue that ultimately saved all six men on board America, plus a cat they had brought along for the trip. Ginsberg sent the story of the rescue in real time to Elmo Pickerel, who fed the story to the AP and the UP as the events unfolded in real time. This event is now regarded as an important milestone in the immediacy of news distribution.
I'm glad they saved the cat. And that certainly explains why Pickerel was experimenting with sending radio transmissions from his plane.
Yes, Pickerel's flight occurred just a couple of months before the America incident in 1910. But keep in mind, by then radio had already been in use aboard seagoing ships for several years. The first emergency use of radio at sea occurred in 1903 when the SS Kronlund lost a propeller and the ship's radio operator, Ludwig Arnson, sent out a CQD distress signal to other ships in the area. That was 7 years prior to Pickerel's flight and the America rescue. It's interesting to note that Arnson and Pickerel knew each other. We actually have a letter in our collection written by Pickerel to Arnson in which he mentioned that he was also chief radio operator aboard the Kronlund. But years later, in 1914 and 15. Because of this letter, we know Pickerel went to work at sea no later than 1914, although we suspect he may have actually done so even earlier than that. At any rate, Pickerel's time aboard Kronlund was also marked by moments of excitement, including an incident in which they received an SOS from the burning SS Volturno. Kronlund responded to the distress signal, and their assistance aided in saving 100 people.
As early as 1915, then, Elmo Pickerel had been involved in wireless radio on the land, the sea, and from the sky.
Yes, and as I hinted at earlier, we suspect that he may have already been working at sea prior to his time on the Kronlund. It must have been very exciting for Pickerel when he landed himself aboard what was likely the most famous ship in the world at the time. SSHSA holds extensive documentation from this period of Pickerel's career. It was during this time that shipboard radio communications proliferated and in exciting new ways, and Pickerel, as usual, was in the thick of it.
So for some context, can you tell us a little bit about the Leviathan?
Sure. Leviathan started out as Hamburg America Line's SS Vaterland. Vaterland was built at Blommenvoss at Hamburg and entered service in 1914 as the largest ship in the world at the time, making its maiden voyage from Cuxhaven to Hoboken in May of that year. The great new ship was luxurious and innovative. For instance, Vaterland's exhaust uptake configuration did not run directly from the boilers through the middle of the vessel to the funnels, as was the convention of the time. Rather, the ducts split and were routed up the sides of the ship, enabling an entirely new configuration of public spaces at sea that afforded uninterrupted views of the ship's grand public rooms and access to them via a grand corridor. This enabled an unobstructed walk between spaces, including the social hall, library, the Palm Court, also known as Winter Garden, the first-class dining room, and the Ritz-Carlton restaurant, which incidentally was a faithful recreation of the restaurant under the same management in New York. The Ritz-Carlton restaurant was the most deluxe and exclusive dining room on board. Here, wrote historian Frank Brainerd, the most wealthy passengers would be able to eat in exclusive luxury and yet be seen by the ordinary first-class passengers just six steps below in the Palm Court. If not the most exclusive space on board, the first-class dining room was certainly the most dramatic. It was the largest space ever seen aboard a ship to that time. It was 100 feet wide and two stories high with a balcony around the second level that included a platform for the ship's orchestra. Diners made their entrance from a grand staircase at the aft end of the saloon, and there were additional entryways in the forward end. Over 700 people could eat in a single sitting, the entirety of first class, and if that weren't enough, two private dining rooms flanked the forward end of the saloon. The high point in the room was the center of a dome that was 31 feet off the floor, and for perspective, that was three times the height of the dining room aboard RMS Olympic, which was only 3 years older.
Wow, that must have made quite an impression on the passengers. Well, the first class passengers, I'm sure the other classes weren't allowed in.
Yes, it did, and these impressions certainly must have contributed to the ship's fame.
Well, I can see why. But then what could have prompted the name change from Vaterland to Leviathan?
Well, the name change occurred in a rather dramatic way, and let's just say it was not the decision of Hamburg America Line. World War I broke out in late July 1914, and Germany quickly jumped in, declaring war on Russia just a few days later on August 1st. That same day, Vaterland was preparing to sail from New York when a cable from Germany arrived warning that British and French cruisers were waiting to seize the ship if it sailed. The voyage was canceled, and Vaterland was consequently trapped in the United States, along with 35 additional German ships. At first, the U.S. seemed like a safe place to keep Vaterland out of harm's way. Vaterland remained at Pier 4 for the next 32 months, a period during which the German crew were marooned in the U.S., being paid but less and less over time as they grew increasingly despondent, unable to get home. More and more, the idle German vessels were viewed as enemy ships by the American public, particularly after the sinking of RMS Lusitania by a U-boat, May 7, 1915. On May 30, 1915, the New York Times published a suggestion that the German ships be seized in response to the Lusitania sinking. As time went on, the languishing ships fell further and further into states of disrepair. In November 1915, the Times published an expose in which Vaterland was described as a German war office. A couple of months later, in January 1916, port officials in New York sealed the aerials aboard Vaterland and disconnected them from the radio shack. It turned out the ship had the capability of sending and receiving radio transmissions completely across the Atlantic. Rumors of the ship being used as a headquarters for enemy spies ran rampant.
So this popular new ship was now considered Germany's secret weapon. What a fall from grace.
Exactly. A little over a year later, the U.S. government made a startling move. In a pre-dawn operation, at 4 a.m. on Friday, April 6, 1917, 200 soldiers on four harbor patrol boats made way to Hoboken and began to seize each of the German liners laid up there one by one. Vaterland was the only vessel of the lot whose machinery was not badly sabotaged by their German crews when taken under American control. There were a few areas of minor damage and some deterioration from years of disuse and neglect, but nothing irreparable. However, nearly every blueprint, wiring schematic, operation manual, and machinery diagram, including those related to the radio equipment on board, was removed from the ship and likely destroyed. Furthermore, America had no experience operating a liner of such immense proportions and was ill-equipped to do so. Nevertheless, with great difficulty and expense, Vaterland was eventually turned into an American troop ship. This involved ripping out 1,200 staterooms to create troop compartments, and every inch of usable space was maximized to carry an estimated 17,000 persons. Extensive damage was done to the ship's interiors and furnishings during this process, and a lot more, including artwork and fine wine from the ship's stores, was simply stolen by the throngs of workers. Still more, including $150,000 of the ship's silver and other accoutrements, were auctioned on the pier at a series of public auctions. Retrofitting the interiors to a troop ship was never planned for by the ship's designers and turned out to be a major undertaking, but getting the ship running again seemed to be an even more Sisyphean task. Every small step of progress was cause for celebration.
Okay, so now that the Vaterland was converted to a U.S. troop ship, I suppose the German name wouldn't really make sense any longer.
Yes, Vaterland translates to Fatherland in English, and such a name would have been inappropriate to say the least, considering the ship's new role fighting German aggression. So the name was officially changed September 6, 1917. President Wilson suggested Leviathan. He pointed to a Bible reference meaning, quote, monster of the deep, end quote. The word itself actually derives from the Hebrew word Leviathan, ironic due to the ship's future role to feeding a nation rife with anti-Semitism. After some final shakedown trials, Leviathan finally sailed again November 17, 1917. This is more than 2 years since her final canceled voyage. The next 2 years, USS Leviathan served as a troop transport during America's involvement in the Great War.
I imagine the Germans would have been quite angry about the loss of the ship. Can you talk about how they handled that situation?
After armistice in 1919, Leviathan, which was still the largest ship in the world, again found itself tied up and in limbo in Hoboken. William Francis Gibbs, who was then with the International Mercantile Marine Company, set about to rebuild Leviathan back into a passenger ship, but the Americans still didn't have a complete set of the ship's plans. The United States Shipping Board approached Germany with a request for plans, but were quoted $1 million for a set. Gibbs himself went to Hamburg to visit Blohm & Voss and could not get them to agree to a lower price, and he was nearly hit more than once by heavy tools that were being deliberately dropped from overhead by irate shipyard workers.
Oh my gosh. So then what did he do? It sounds like the Germans didn't take it very well at all.
Not at all. Gibbs' unpleasant experience with the hostile Germans prompted him to attempt the impossible, create his own set of plans of the ship from scratch. To do this, every cubic inch of the mammoth ship had to be measured and blueprinted by hand. Eventually, he succeeded in modernizing, overhauling, and outfitting the ship in preparation for its return to commercial service. It was a monumental undertaking that took years to complete. Finally, on May 7, 1923, Gibbs announced the Leviathan's crew would be nearly 100% American when put back into service, and he started to assemble a crew. That same day, Elmo Neal Pickerel was named to serve as chief radio operator. Leviathan's funnels were now freshly painted red, white, and blue, an appropriate color scheme for the Grand Dame of the American Merchant Marine, as well as the nascent United States lines. July 4, 1923, a symbolic date, was announced for the ship's first post-war voyage from New York to Cherbourg and Southampton. Among other improvements, Leviathan returned to service with a full complement of upgraded onboard communication and entertainment equipment, and it was Pickerel's responsibility to maintain and operate it all, with plenty of help from his underlings, of course.
Okay, so how long was Elmo Pickerel in that position as chief radio operator for the Leviathan?
Elmo Pickerel held his position as chief radio operator for much of the remainder of the great ship's career. A large volume of the papers and mementos he saved from this time period were donated to Steamship Historical Society in 1968 when he passed away. These include, but are not limited to, signage from Leviathan's radio room, Pickerel's badge, epaulets, certification cards, 137 crew passes, 168 log abstract cards, photographs, souvenir type objects, silver, correspondence, clippings, memoranda, books, and a very large 48-star American flag that purportedly was flown aboard Leviathan. But two groupings of materials within that donation stand out as exceptional records of what it was like to work in the radio department of an early 20th century ocean liner. The first grouping is Pickerel's photographs that he kept in a large bound album. The second grouping are documents stored inside of two file boxes stamped SS Leviathan on their spines. These boxes were apparently saved from the radio room by Pickerel when the ship went out of service for the last time in 1934. Work has been going on at SSHSA to more thoroughly document and understand the contents of these boxes.
So were there any revelations or great insights you gained while processing this collection?
Well, while poring over the records, it became clear that the radio crew was kept busy with a wide array of duties above and beyond simply operating the radio, and maintaining a paper trail of all these activities was certainly one of them. To start with, sending and receiving radio messages to land and other vessels was an important aspect of the radio room operation and a big source of income for the company. The number of messages and words sent over the ship's radio were logged daily, as they needed to be carefully accounted for. Such messages were referred to as traffic, and passengers paid to use the service. The radio staff routinely made rounds through the ship's public rooms to solicit traffic from the passengers, and of course generate revenue. Consequently, they had to handle money and manage it as well, but that was just one aspect of their daily routines. Pickerel and his staff were also responsible for supply procurement, systems and equipment testing and repairs, Leviathan's public address system, Victrolas and telephones, ensuring radio-equipped lifeboats were at the ready, broadcasting concerts, speeches, and other special events to and from the ship, and compliance with a whole host of company and regulatory policies.
So it seems like the work of the radio staff was mostly behind the scenes. So I guess it could be easy for people to overlook their contribution to the smooth operation of a ship.
Right. In many ways, they were unsung heroes. Passengers probably didn't realize that the work done by the radio crew was so contributory to their comfort and entertainment at sea.
So how do you envision these papers being used by researchers or historians?
Well, I'm certain that diehard Leviathan fanatics and historians alike will go gaga over these papers. The files are truly a treasure trove of minutiae. There are equipment inventory listings that show the exact makers and model numbers of each component on board and their technical specifications. Also included are parts inventories, onboard loudspeaker locations, procedures for preparing and conducting VIP transatlantic calls, reports of equipment failures and tests, requests for new radio tubes and popular dance records, incident reports, disciplinary problems, grievances, uniform regulations, operating procedures, onboard audio broadcasting schedules, including special events, and so on and so on. My favorite document is an inventory of 10-inch 78 RPM records and record albums played on the ship. It was dated June 11, 1931. That includes details of the record's labels, artists, and song titles. It's been fun perusing that playlist on YouTube and just imagining the atmosphere on board as passengers enjoyed those actual songs. Another favorite of mine is a letter from Pickerel written 2 months before the maiden voyage, wherein he proposed an industry innovation that was eventually tested and implemented aboard Leviathan. In the letter, Pickerel suggests that in addition to simple radiogram messages, the same service could be used to wire funds to passengers through the onboard bank branch of the Farmers Loan and Trust Company, or to send passengers flowers delivered fresh from the flower shop, or boxes of cigars, and other items from the Leviathan's shops.
I would think a lot of people would really enjoy the 1920s pop music and relate to being able to wire people flowers. Are there any other materials in the collection that would appeal to a wider audience than sort of the diehard maritime historians?
Oh, definitely. Particularly Elmo Pickerel's photo album kept during his time on Leviathan. A lot of people will find it fascinating. As you might expect, Pickerel kept rather ordinary kinds of snapshots, showing himself with friends, family, and colleagues at sea and also ashore in Europe. And as the radio geek he was, he took detailed photographs of the ship's radio equipment. However, this is where it gets interesting. The album also contains a large number of images showing the diverse array of Leviathan's VIP passengers, including vaudeville and movie stars, singers, fellow aviators, and radio pioneers, politicians, royalty, musicians, athletes, military brass, authors, and other notable figures, too numerous to mention. The ship was a revolving door of the rich and famous, and the album clearly shows that Elmo Pickerel rubbed elbows with all of them.
Wow, it sounds like that album really captures the glamour and excitement of the ship.
Absolutely. Like I said before, life aboard Leviathan must have been as exciting to Elmo Pickerel and his crew as it was to the passengers. Every voyage was a different experience. By 1968, when Pickerel passed on, he had lived long enough to see jet planes render the great liners obsolete relics of a bygone age. He did not live long enough, however, to defend 21st century allegations that brought into question his role in the first air-to-ground radio transmission in 1910. Perhaps he would have been able to explain the discrepancies in his account of the event, and maybe he would not have been able to. Nevertheless, Elmo Neil Pickerel lived an exciting life, and a good number of his papers, photographs, and other artifacts live on at SSHSA and in other repositories, and for that we should feel both fortunate and grateful.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today about this really important collection.
You're very welcome. It was my pleasure.
Thanks for tuning into Ship History Radio. We hope you enjoyed hearing about the Pickerel Collection with our curator, Jordan Burson. You can learn more about this and other collections in our archive by visiting sshsa.org/collections. If you're enjoying this podcast, consider leaving us a review. Until next time, fair winds and following seas.